The recognition of a parallel between UFO reports and the main themes of fairy lore is the first indication I have found that a way might exist out of this dilemma. And although it is still too early for us to pick up the scattered pieces of our old theories in a new attempt at explanation, I would like to conclude this chapter with a more precise review of the most difficult cases we have before us. Of the reasonable sightings, there is little that can be said. The real problem begins when we find witnesses who are typical of the average population and who tell a story that, though not inconsistent with the spectrum of UFO reports, still stands out because of a few specific details that are so unbelievable that our first reaction is to reject the entire story. The thought that the story must be disregarded because it is a challenge to our reason is a reaction I am very familiar with, and it has led me in the past to select for analysis only those sightings that seem amenable to scientific criticism. Similarly, major groups such as Nikapori Pro and the official investigators working for Project Blue Book have devised some more or less conscious standards for the automatic rejection of unbelievable stories. To be sure, many of these reports do deserve the crackpot label, but such stories are usually accompanied by numerous signs of the witness's lack of mental balance. But when no such psychological context is evident, we must appraise the story very carefully. October 12, 1963. It was raining hard between Monte Maze and Isla Verde, in Argentina, as Eugenio Douglas drove his truck loaded with coal along the road. Dawn was coming. Suddenly, Douglas saw a bright spot on the road ahead, like the headlights of an approaching vehicle, except that it was a single, blinding light. To avoid a collision, Douglas slowed down. The light became so intense he had to lower his head and move to the side. He stopped the truck and got out. The light had disappeared. Through the rain, Eugenio Douglas could now see a circular metallic craft, about 35 feet high. An opening became visible, making a second area of light, less intense, and three figures appeared. They looked like men, but they were wearing strange headdresses with things like antennae attached to the headpieces. They were over 12 feet tall. There was nothing repulsive about the entities, said Douglas, but he was terribly scared. As soon as he was seen by the figures, a ray of red light flashed to the spot where he stood and burnt him. Grabbing a revolver, he fired at the three entities and ran off toward Monte Maze. But the burning red light followed him as far as the village, where it interfered with the street lights, turning them violet and green. Douglas could smell a pungent gas. The beauty and dramatic character of that scene is impressive, and in a screen illustration of the UFO saga, this is probably the sighting that would best carry its total meaning. Douglas ran to the first house and shouted for help. Rivers, the owner, had died the previous night, but his family, gathered around the body, reported that at the same time they heard Douglas's call, the candles in the room and the electric lights in the house turned green, and the same strange smell was noticed. They rushed to open the door. There was Douglas in the pouring rain, his overcoat over his head and a gun in his hand. The street lights had changed color. It must have been one of the most fantastic scenes in the rich archives of ufology. Eugenio Douglas was taken to the police station, where the burns on his face and hands were clearly seen. The police, it turned out, had received a number of calls about the light's color change, but they had attributed the change to irregularities in the local power plant, which, however, would hardly account for the change in the candle lights, if that particular observation was not an illusion. Douglas was examined by a doctor, who stated the burns had been caused by a radiation similar to ultraviolet. According to Douglas, he had felt a burn when exposed to a red beam. When villagers went to the site where the truck was still parked, they found large footprints, nearly 20 inches long, but they were shortly afterward washed away by rain. In late August, 1963, near the town of Sagra de Famila, Brazil, three boys, Fernando Astagio, 11, his brother Ronaldo, 9, and a neighbor named Marcos, went into the Astagio garden and started to draw water from the well. Suddenly they became aware of a hovering sphere above the trees. They could even second 4 or 5 toes of people inside the sphere. An opening under the sphere became visible, and 2 light rays shot downward. A slender, 10-foot-tall being came down, as if gliding on the 2 beams of light. He alighted in the garden and walked for 20 feet or so in an odd fashion. His back seemed stiff. His legs were open, and his arms outstretched. He swung his body from left to right as if trying to find his balance and then sat down on a rock. The 3 boys observed that the giant wore a transparent helmet and had in the middle of his forehead what they described as a dark eye. He wore tall boots, each of which was equipped with a strange triangular spike, which made a peculiar impression in the soft ground and could be seen for several days afterward. His garment was shiny and had inflated as soon as the entity had touched the ground. The trousers seemed to be fastened tightly to the boots. He had a peculiar square pack on his chest, which emitted flashes of light in an intermittent manner. Inside the sphere, still hanging motionless above the garden, the 3 boys could see occupants behind control panels turning knobs and flicking switches. When the giant in the garden made a motion as if to grab one of the boys, Fernando picked up a stone, only to find himself unable to do anything with it as the spaceman looked straight into his eyes. The giant then returned to the sphere, still using the light beams as an elevator but holding his arms close to his body this time. The boys were no longer afraid, although they could not account for their new feeling. As the sphere left, they were sure the giant spaceman had not come to hurt them, and somehow, in the same irrational fashion, they knew he would come back again. In Brazil, 6 years earlier, an incident had taken place that has gained in UFO literature the place it certainly deserves, thanks to an excellent investigation by the late Professor Olavo Font, of the National School of Medicine in Rio de Janeiro, who interviewed and examined the witness, A. Villas Boas, of São Francisco de Sales, Minas Gerais. On the night of October 5, 1957, Antonio and his brother went to bed about 11 p.m. The night was hot, and as he opened the window, Antonio saw a silvery light in the corral similar to the spot made by a powerful searchlight. Later that night, the 2 brothers observed the light was still there. Then it moved toward the house, sweeping the roof before going away. About 10 p.m. on October 14, Antonio was plowing with his tractor when he saw a blinding white light at the northern end of the field. Every time Antonio tried to approach it, the light moved away. This happened about 20 times, though the light always appeared to wait for him. His second brother was watching the scene as Antonio finally gave up. The light simply vanished. The next evening Antonio was alone at the same spot. The night was cold, clear, and starry. At 1 a.m. he saw something like a red star, which grew larger and became an egg-like, bright object, which hovered above his tractor, then landed softly. Antonio tried to drive away, but the engine of the tractor died. He jumped down and took 2 steps, but someone caught his arm. After a short struggle, 4 men carried him inside the craft. The beings communicated among themselves in slowly emitted growls, unlike any sound the witness could reproduce, although they were neither high-pitched nor too low. In spite of his resistance, the creatures stripped him, washed his body with something like a wet sponge, and took him into another room through a strangely lettered door. It is not my purpose here to record all the details of the experience reported by Villas Boas. They have been adequately documented first in the Flying Saucer Review by Fonts and Creighton and later by the Lorenzkens, who provide a complete reprint of the testimony as recorded by Fonts and J. Martins, along with the professional opinion of Dr. Fonts after his medical examination of the witness, in their book Flying Saucer Occupants. Fonts's conclusion that Villas Boas is not mentally unbalanced and that he is sincere in reporting his story is what prompts me to include the story here. And the story docs provide a link between such tales as the story of Ossian and the general question of the genetic context of the UFO myth, which will be the object of the next section of this chapter. Antonio remained alone in the room for what seemed to him a very long time. When he heard a noise at the door, he turned and received a terrible shock. The door was open and a woman came in, as naked as he was. Her hair was blonde, with a part in the center. She had blue eyes, rather longer than round, slanted outward. Her nose was straight, her cheekbones prominent. Her face looked very wide, wider than that of an Indio native. It ended in a pointed chin. Her lips were very thin, nearly invisible, in fact. Her ears were small but ordinary. She was much shorter than he was, her head only reaching his shoulder. She quickly made clear to him what the purpose of her visit was. Soon after, in fact, another man came in and beckoned to the woman, who, pointing to her belly, smiled, pointed at the sky, and followed the man out. The men came back with Antonio's clothes, then took him to a room where the other crew members were sitting, growling among themselves. The witness, who felt sure no harm would come to him now, carefully observed his surroundings. Among other things, all his remarks here are of interest. He noticed a box with a glass top that had the appearance of an alarm clock. The clock had one hand and several marks that would correspond to the 3, 6, 9, and 12 of an ordinary clock. However, although time passed, the hands did not move, and Antonio concluded that it was no clock. The symbolism in this remark by Villas-Boas is clear. We are reminded of the fairy tales quoted above, of the country where time does not pass, and of that great poet who had in his room a huge white clock without hands, bearing the word "It is later than you think." It is the poetic quality of such details in many UFO sightings that catches the attention, in spite of the irrational, or obviously absurd, character of the tale, and makes it so similar to a dream. Antonio must have thought so, because he reflected that he must bring some evidence back and tried to STR:I. The clock. At once, one of the men shoved him to the side angrily. This attempt to secure evidence is a constant feature of fairy tales, and we are also reminded of the efforts by Betty Hill to convince her captors to let her take a peculiar book she saw inside their craft. As in the Villas-Boas incident, the men denied her the opportunity to convince the world that the experience had been real. As last, one of the men motioned Antonio to follow him to a circular platform. He was then given a detailed tour of the machine, taken to a metal ladder, and signaled to go down. Antonio watched all the details of the preparation for takeoff and observed the craft as it rose from the ground and flew away in a matter of seconds. He noticed that the time was 5:30. He had spent over 4 hours inside the strange machine. It must be noted that the witness volunteered information about the sighting in general terms when a notice appeared in a newspaper calling for UFO reports. He was extremely reluctant to discuss the more personal aspects of his experience and related them only when questioned with insistence by Fonts and Martens. Like Morris Mass, Villas-Boas suffered from excessive sleepiness for about a month after the incident. Demonialitis. When folklore becomes degraded to a minor literary form, as the fairy faith was degraded to the fairy tales we know today, it naturally loses much of its content, precisely those adult details that cannot be allowed to remain in children's books. The direct result of the censorship of spicy details in these marvelous stories is that they really become mere occasions for amazement. The Villas-Boas case is hardly appropriate for nursery school reading, but to eliminate the little lady from the story would turn it into a tale without deep symbolic or psychological value. The sexual context is precisely what gives such accounts their literary influence. It is what provides impact to the fairy faith. Without the sexual context, without the stories of changelings, human midwives, intermarriage with the gentry, of which we never hear in modern fairy tales, it is doubtful that the tradition about fairies would have survived through the ages. Nor is that true only of fairies. I most remarkable cases of sexual contact with non-humans are not found in spicy saucer books, nor in fairy legends. They rest, safely stored away, in the archives of the Catholic Church. To find them, one must first learn Latin and gain entrance into the few libraries where these unique records are preserved. But the accounts one finds them make the Villas-Boas case pale by comparison. as I believe the reader will agree before the end of this chapter. Let us first establish clearly that the belief in the possibility of intermarriage between man and the non-human races we are studying is a corollary to the apparitions in all historical contexts. This is so obvious in biblical stories that I hardly need elaborate. The sex of the angels is not the most difficult, on the contrary, it is the clearest, of all theological questions. In Anatole France's Revolt of the Angels it is Arcade, one of the celestial beings, who says, "There's nothing like having sound references." In order to assure yourself that I am not deceiving you, Morris, on this subject of the amorous embraces of angels and women, look up Justin, Apologies I and II, Flavins Josephus, Jewish Antiquities, Book I, Chapter 3, Athenagoras, Concerning the Resurrection, Lactantius, Book 2, Chapter 15, Tertullian, On the Veil of the Virgins, Marcus of Ifsens Insulus, Eusebius, Preparatio Evangelica, Book V, Chapter 4, St. Ambrose, in his book on Noah and the Ark, Chapter 5, St. Augustine in his City of God, Book 15, Chapter 23, Father Meldonat, the Jesuit, Treatise on Demons, Page 248. Thus spoke Arcade, his guardian angel, to poor Morris, as he tried to apologize for having stolen his mistress, pretty Madam Gilberty. And he added shamelessly, "It was bound to be so, all the other angels in revolt would have done as I did with Gilberty." Women, saith the apostle, should pray with their heads covered, because of the angels. W. This is clear enough. But fairies and elves? Are they subject to such carnal desires? Consider the following facts. In the preface of the saga of Rolf, Torfus, a 17th century Danish historian, records statements made about the elves by Inard Guzmund, the Icelandic scholar, "I am convinced they really do exist, and they are creatures of God, that they get married like we do, and have children of either sex. We have a proof of this in what we know of the love of some of their women with simple mortals." William Grant Stewart, in the Popular Superstitions and Festive Amusements of the Highlanders of Scotland, devotes the second part of his discussion to fairies. In a chapter entitled Of the Passions and Propensities of the Fairies, he has this to say on sexual intercourse with them: "The fairies are remarkable for the amorousness of their dispositions, and are not very backward in forming attachments and connections with the people that cannot with propriety be called their own species." This is a beautiful example of convoluted phraseology. Stewart is less obviously embarrassed when he reports that such events no longer seem to take place between men and fairies. We owe it, in justice to both the human and the fairy communities of the present day, to say that such intercourse as that described to have taken place betwixt them is now extremely rare, with the single exception of a good old shoemaker, now or lately living in the village of Tumantool, who confesses having had some dalliances with a Lananshi in his younger days. We do not know personally anyone who has carried matters this length. If Stewart came back today, he would have to revise this statement after reading UFO material. Kirk stated the case more clearly when he said, "In our Scotland there are numerous and beautiful creatures of that aerial order, who frequently assign meetings to lascivious young men as succubi, or as joyous mistresses and prostitutes, who are called Lianain Scythe or familiar spirits." I hardly need to remind the reader of the importance of such familiar spirits in medieval occultism, particularly in Rosicrucian theories. Nor do I need to mention the number of accused witches who were condemned to death on the evidence that they had such familiar spirits. There is no gap between the fairy faith and ufology regarding the sexual question. This is apparent from the study made by Wentz, who records, for example, the following story: "My grandmother Catherine MacInnes used to tell about a man named Lachlan, whom she knew, being in love with a fairy woman. The fairy woman made it a point to see Lachlan every night, and he being worn out with her began to fear her. Things got so bad at last that he decided to go to America to escape the fairy woman. As soon as the plan was fixed and he was about to emigrate, women who were milking at sunset out in the meadows heard very audibly the fairy woman singing this song, What will the brown-haired woman do when Lachie is on the billows? Lachie emigrated to Cape Breton, landing at Pictou, Nova Scotia, and in his first letter home to his friends he stated that the same fairy woman was haunting him there in America. The comments by Wentz on this case are extremely important. To discover a tale so rare and curious as this is certainly of all our evidence highly interesting. And aside from its high literary value, it proves conclusively that the fairy women who entice mortals to their love in modern times are much the same, if not the same, as the succubi of Middle Age mystics. This allows us to return to the religious records mentioned above, one of which offers one of the most remarkable cases of apparition I have ever come across. It is difficult to believe that stories exist that surpass, for their amazing contents or shocking features, some of the reports we have already studied, such as the Hills case or the Villas-Boas report. But, remarkable as they are, these latter two accounts refer only to one aspect of the total phenomenon. They can be interpreted only after being placed within the continuum of hundreds of lesser-known cases, which provide the necessary background. The following case stands alone, and it is unique in that it relates the apparition of an incubus with the poltergeist phenomenon. The authority upon which the case rests is that of Fr. Ludovicus Maria Sinistrari D.C. Amcno, who reports and discusses it in his manuscript De Demonialitate, et Incubis, 8 secundis, 22, written in the second half of the 17th century. Who is Fr. Sinistrari? A theologian scholar born in Amino, Italy, on February 26, 1622, he studied in Pavia and entered the Franciscan order in 1647. He devoted his life to teaching philosophy and theology to numerous students attracted to Pavia by his fame as an eminent scholar. He also served as counselor to the Supreme Tribunal of the Inquisition and as theologian attached to the Archbishop of Milan. In 1688 he supervised the compilation of the statutes of the Franciscan order. He died in 1701. Among other books, Fr. Sinistrari published a treatise called De Delictis et Poenas, which is an exhaustive compilation tractatus absolutissimus of all the crimes and sins imaginable. In short, Fr. Sinistrari was one of the highest authorities on human psychology and religious law to serve the Catholic Church in the 17th century. Compared to his De Demonialitate, Playboy is a rather innocent gathering of mild reveries. The good father writes, "About 25 years ago, while I was a professor of sacred theology at the Holy Cross Convent in Pavia, there lived in that city a married woman of excellent morality. All who knew her, and particularly the clergy, had nothing but the highest praises for her. Her name was Hieronyma, and she lived in the St. Michael parish. One day, Hieronyma prepared some bread and brought it to the baker's to have it baked. He brought it back to her, and at the same time he brought her a large pancake of a very peculiar shape, made with butter and Venetian pastes, such as they used to make cakes in that city. She refused it, saying she had not prepared anything like it. But," said the baker, "I have not had any bread to bake today but yours. The pancake must come from your house too, your memory probably fails you." The good lady allowed herself to be convinced. She took the pancake and ate it with her husband, her three-year-old daughter, and a servant girl. During the following night, while she was in bed with her husband and both were asleep, she found herself awakened by an extremely fine voice, somewhat like a high-pitched whistling sound. It was softly saying in her ear some very clear words, "How did you like the cake?" In fear, our good lady began to use the sign of the cross and to invoke in succession the names of Jesus and Mary. "Fear naught," said the voice. "I mean no harm to you. On the contrary, there is nothing I would not do in order to please you. I am in love with your beauty, and my greatest desire is to enjoy your embraces." At the same time, she felt that someone was kissing her cheeks, but so softly and gently that she might have thought it was only the finest cotton down touching her. She resisted, without answering anything, only repeating many times the names of Jesus and Mary and making the sign of the cross. The temptation lasted thus about half an hour, after which time the tempter went away. In the morning, the lady went to her confessor, a wise and knowledgeable man, who confirmed her in the ways of the faith and appealed to her to continue her strong resistance, and to use some holy relics. The following night, similar temptations, with words and kisses of the same kind, similar opposition, too, from the lady. However, as she was tired of such lasting trials, she took the advice of her confessor and other serious men and asked to be examined by trained exorcists to decide whether or not she was possessed. The exorcists found nothing in her to indicate the presence of the evil spirit. They blessed the house, the bedroom, the bed, and gave the incubus orders to discontinue his importunities. All was in vain. He went on tempting her, pretending he was dying with love, and crying, moaning, in order to invoke the lady's pity. With God's help, she remained unmoved. Then the incubus used a different approach. He appeared to her in the figure of a young boy or small man with golden, curling hair, with a blonde beard gleaming like golden sea-green eyes. To add to his power of seduction, he was elegantly dressed in Spanish vestments. Besides, he kept appearing to her even when she was in company. He would complain, as lovers do, he would send her kisses. In a word, he used all the means of seduction to obtain her favors. Only she saw and heard him. To all others, there was nothing. Ting's excellent woman had kept her unwavering determination for several months when the incubus had recourse to a new kind of persecution. First, he took from her a silver cross full of holy relics and a blessed wax or papal iamb of Pope Pius V, which she always had on her. Then, rings and other jewels of gold and silver followed. He stole them without touching the locks of the casket in which they were enclosed. Then he began to strike her cruelly, and after each series of blows one could see on her face, arm, or other areas of her body bruises and marks, which lasted 1 or 2 days, then vanished suddenly, quite unlike natural bruises, which go away by degrees. Sometimes, as she suckled her daughter, Lai took the child from her knees and carried her to the roof, placing her at the edge of their gutter, or else he would hide her, but without ever causing her harm. He would also upset the household, sometimes breaking to pieces the plates and earthenware, but in the blink of an eye he also restored them to their original state. One night, as she lay in bed with her husband, the incubus, appearing to her under his usual form, energetically demanded that she give herself up. She refused, as usual. Furious, the incubus went away, and a short time later he returned with an enormous load of those flat stones that inhabitants of Genoa, and of Liguria in general, used to cover their houses. With these stones he built around the bed such a high wall that it reached almost to the ceiling, and the couple had to send for a ladder in order to come out. This wall was built without lime. It was pulled down and the stones were stored in a corner, where they were exposed to everyone's sight. But after 2 days they vanished. On the day of Saint Stephen, the lady's husband had invited several military friends to dine with him. To honor his guests he had prepared a respectable dinner. While they were washing their hands according to the custom, suddenly the table vanished, along with the dishes, the cauldrons, the plates, and all the earthenware in the kitchen, the jugs, the bottles, the glasses too. You can imagine the amazement, the surprise, of the guests. There were 8 of them, among them a Spanish infantry captain who told them, "Do not be afraid. It is only a trick. But there used to be a table here, and it must still be here. I am going to find it." Having said that, he went around the room with outstretched hands, attempting to seize the table. But after he had made many turns, seeing he was only touching air, the others laughed at him. And since dinner time had passed, everyone took his coat and started for home. They had already reached the door with the husband, who was politely accompanying them, when they heard a great noise in the dining room. They stopped to find out what it was, and the servant girl ran and told them the kitchen was full of new plates loaded with food, and the table had come back in the dining room. The table was now covered with napkins, dishes, glasses, and silverware that were not the original ones. And there were all kinds of precious cups full with rare wines. In the kitchen, too, there were new jugs and utensils, they had never been seen there before. The guests, however, were hungry, and they ate this strange meal, which they found very much to their taste.